All right, so we're back in Data World with Dr. Brian Beckman again, the physicist we've had before.
Yes.
So what's going on here? I hear that you're kind of into games. I didn't know that about you.
Yes, I have well, obviously I'm a physicist, as you said, and I've got a background in gaming. I had the privilege of doing a little bit of tire physics work for Forza, which is one of the Xbox titles.
Okay.
It's a racing simulator. Uh-huh. Forza.
And Forza.
Yeah, Forza.
You got it.
I worked
Italian.
With Andrea Forza, Maranello, the Prancing Stallion.
Excellent.
I worked with Andrew Curtis and Dave Guyrock over there, who are just top guys, and I helped them out with the mathematics behind the tire physics.
Okay.
So one of the things people don't realize is how complicated a tire is.
Yes, agreed.
You know, and... the first games that had accurate physics in them that came out were flight simulators. They came out as early as 1982. Mm-hmm. And let me page forward here in this thing. I have a little presentation here.
Good.
Some of what I'm going to tell you is based on this talk that I've been shopping around on real-time simulation, which is really code speak for physics in games.
Okay.
And let me page forward quickly through the first few, because I want to get to the flight simulator and then segue back to tires.
Absolutely.
Real-time simulation is simulation in which the speed of the computation is approximately equal to the speed of real phenomena. Hmm. So astrophysics is definitely not real-time simulation, because you compute, you know, do a few weeks of computation to simulate a few billion years of galaxy formation.
Yeah.
And then quantum mechanics or electronics or particle physics is the opposite extreme. You may do a few weeks of calculation on a computer to simulate a picosecond of real time. That's a trillionth of a second.
Okay.
But game physics is a sweet spot. It's not only an economic sweet spot, because games make money. Astrophysics doesn't make money.
Sure.
Particle physics doesn't make money. Electronics makes money.
Yeah.
So simulation in electronics is very important, big business. Mm-hmm. It's also known as CAD-CAM.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
So, I mean, there are other kinds of CAD-CAM, but one of the biggest areas for CAD-CAM is electronics.
Okay.
Where you do lots of very non-real-time simulation, doing solid-state physics in circuits. But this is an economic, game physics is an economic sweet spot, and it's also a technical sweet spot.
Okay.
Because if you need to make your computation go at roughly the same speed of real phenomena, a whole bunch of interesting technical problems arise.
Mm-hmm.
If you're freed from that constraint, as in astrophysics or quantum mechanics, then you just write your physics code, mm-hmm. and you can do anything you want with it. You can make it more accurate, more faithful, less accurate, less faithful, you know.
So just let me interject to be clear here what you're saying is. When I'm playing a game,
yes,
obviously when I turn the joystick to the left.
Yes.
I expect the plane to bank to the left.
Yes.
Just after I did it, or pretty much in real time.
Pretty much
in real
time.
That's what you're talking about.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Or if in a racing game, in fact, this would be the two themes that we'll compare and contrast.
Mm-hmm.
Flight simulation versus race car simulation. Because one of the points I want to beat on is that racing physics took a long time to come to the world, you know, to come to the world of marketable games. There were simulators based on, you know, big heavy iron and big mainframes before they came out on PC class machines.
Okay.
But it took a long time, and that's because the physics in a race car is actually a lot more complicated than the physics in an airplane.
Interesting.
Which is counterintuitive. Most people don't think of airplanes as particularly simple,
mm-hmm.
but in fact, as far as the equations of physics go, they're much simpler than race cars.
Because they don't have to deal with things like gravitational or whatever, friction of the ground surface.
That's not the hard
So
part.
What else? I'm glad to hear about this. Okay, all right, good.
So let me page through a couple of these things quickly. As I go through this, I make the point that we need to write games for the computers that people have
mm-hmm.
versus games for the computers that people want. That's an Amiga circa 1987, and you would be forgiven for thinking that's a modern computer. But it was very expensive, and IBM computers were the target for games. Caltech Hypercube. I want to come back to that a little bit later if we have time. But what I really want to get to is flight simulators and race car simulators.
So sure.
Reuse software. We all know in physics there's numerical problems and so on. The first thing you need to do is get to market, because if you don't start making money from your physics, you're not going to be able to do your physics for very long. So Flight Simulator is a spectacularly popular game.
Absolutely.
And it's been around since 1982. The first color snapshot I could find was 84.
Okay.
There's an 82 snapshot around, but it's black and white and pretty ugly. Mm-hmm. So what's in the physics of an airplane? Oh, by the way, this is a screenshot from Flight Simulator 2004.
Okay.
And I defy anybody to tell me that that isn't to find anything in this picture that tells you it's not a photograph. That's how realistic it is.
Absolutely.
It's unbelievably well done.
Agreed.
The lighting, the clouds, the simulation of the clouds, the grounds, it's just everything is fantastic.
Now, of course, there's physics in that simulation as
well.
You
betcha, yes. So
okay.
So let's rewind to 84. a PC of 84 is not as powerful as my wristwatch of today.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow we managed to do real-time physics simulation of airplanes on it.
Nice.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So what's involved in the physics of an airplane? There are four forces on an airplane: lift, gravity, thrust, and drag.
Mm-hmm.
And the equations of motion of an airplane are really, there are just three coordinate systems. Let me call it two and a half.
Okay.
That you need to deal with. One of them, symbolized in blue here, if you can see the blue, is the Earth-based or inertial coordinate frame. That is the frame in which the laws of physics have their simplest form.
Okay.
The red frame here symbolizes the local frame of the airplane. This is the frame that's fixed to the airplane body, and it's the one that you feel that you're in mm-hmm. when you're piloting the airplane. So as you move the airplane around, you feel forces jerking you this way and that way. Maybe if you get some turbulence or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
In a real airplane, you would feel these inertial forces. That's caused by the motion of the red frame, which is moving, mm-hmm. with respect to the blue frame, which is not moving.
Okay.
So all you need to do real-time physics of an airplane is simulate the motion of that red frame with respect to the blue frame. The equations for doing this are very well known, been known since the time of Euler, and there they are. They're a little bit nonlinear.
Mm-hmm.
I won't go into explaining the details of them, other than to say that I is the moment of inertia, which is something that you calculate from the body of the airplane. It's, you know, so much mass here, so much mass there. You do it by the distribution of weights, a measure of the distribution of weights.
Mm-hmm.
And omega, that's Greek omega, measures the speed of rotation around three axes. One, two, three axes.
Okay.
Yaw, pitch, and roll.
Hmm.
Pretty much, that's it. These equations of physics, and these are the torques, by the way, which are, if you get a little bit of lift on the wing, then that's the torque that causes you to roll the plane, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you get a little lift on the elevator in the back, that causes pitch, and rudder forces cause yaw.
Okay.
So there's roll, pitch, and yaw, and that causes the angular velocity, the speed with which the angles are changing,
mm-hmm.
to move around, and it's kind of multiplied by this mass distribution. Obviously, if the mass is concentrated in the center of the plane, it likes to spin more than if the mass is spread out in the wings and so on.
Okay.
Not a whole lot of physics there. Few dozen lines of C code at most, and that's if you're being really detailed about it. That's pretty much it for Flight Simulator. simple planes are easy. Okay, so this is a little thing I picked out of somebody sent around an email with homework problems that were funny. Some poor student got lost in his calculation and hung himself on the square root sign.
Excellent.
It was an exam. He was trying to solve this exam.
That's excellent.
Simple planes are easy. There's really one input to the dynamics. This is angle of attack. And I'm going to keep coming back to this as I get into tires. Angle of attack is the difference, the angular difference between the direction the plane is pointing
mm-hmm.
and the direction the plane is going. So airplanes tend to kite a little bit on the wind, which means their nose is a little bit up
mm-hmm.
with respect to the direction they're going. The plane is going this way, and you just kind of kite it a little bit so that you get lift. you look up all of these forces, lift and drag, and what do we have? Thrust and gravity. Thrust comes from an engine model, which is, you know, how hard are you squeezing the trigger on the joystick, or how hard have you pushed the throttle.
Okay.
Gravity is fixed.
Sure.
And lift and drag, you look up from a table. You just have a table in your program, and give it the angle of attack, look up, lift and drag out of a table. Really simple. So now that accounts for another few dozen lines of code. You can imagine in 1984, you're not going to be able to do more than a few hundred lines of code in real time. That means every 30th of a second, you have to calculate the complete physics of an airplane. Well, so I just showed you the complete physics of an airplane is not very complicated.
Okay.
So it's not all that hard. And even the wings, which are pretty complicated, but they're not super complicated. You just do table lookups. Over the years, we've added improvements to flight simulator, like accounting for temperature and humidity. Planes operate different on humid days than on non-humid days. Cold air, hot air. Wing flex, fuselage flex, that's all very interesting stuff. Ground effect is extremely important. Float, you know, when you try to land a plane.
Absolutely.
It likes to float before it hits the deck. And weather and so on. But look, why not do cars first? For every pilot in the world, there must be 100 drivers. Or 1,000 drivers.
Absolutely.
So if you're trying to sell games, the first game you're not going to write is not the first game you're going to write is not going to be a flight simulator. It's going to be a car simulator. So why didn't we do cars in 1984? Well, we wanted to.
Really?
Just couldn't do it in real time.
Interesting.
The physics is a lot more complicated. Let's look at some of the things that are at play in an automobile.
Cars are nasty.
Cars are really complicated. They're much more complicated than airplanes. First of all, if you analogize a tire to a wing, the wing in an airplane is the thing that generates the force that keeps the airplane moving the way you want it to move. That could be said, just substitute tire and car in there. The tire is the thing on a car that keeps the car moving the way you want it to go.
Yeah.
But you got four of them. And they're connected to the car by these complicated linkages. Maybe they're McPherson struts, maybe they're A-frames, maybe they're independent coilover suspensions, maybe they're, what are they called, leaf springs. All of these things act differently. So each different car is going to have not just different shades of physics, completely different kinds of physics, completely different equations. You have to account for these suspensions if you're going to do an accurate simulation that feels like you're driving a car. Now, we had arcade games for cars. That's where the car just kind of moves around on a track, and maybe it'll have some visual simulation of sliding sideways. And
sure.
Make it exciting and so on. There's not much physics in there. It's called kinematic, which means that the motion is just calculated by stepping the velocity forward in time and faking all the physics. Mm-hmm. But if you want to have a good car simulator, you have to simulate the suspension components and how they hook up to one another. There are people doing research on simulation for articulated bodies today. I have two PhD theses on my desk right now, written within the last 10 years about problems doing this. Okay. It's still complicated. It's still hard. It's not completely solved, just from the physics point of view, from the computational physics point of view. The actual physics was solved a long time ago, but doing things on a computer is different from doing things in an abstract physics form where you're just writing down analytical solutions. But back to the car, there's something else involved in it. So not only do we have complicated and all kinds of a large variety of complicated suspension configurations to deal with, we multiply it by four.
Okay.
An airplane, you know, the early flight simulators just treated the airplane as a single wing, and a refinement would be maybe two wings, and maybe, you know, considering the control surfaces. So you kind of multiply these simple objects, you still don't get a whole lot more complexity. You get a whole lot more complexity when you multiply these tire and suspension components by four, because each one of them is independently in contact with the ground. And so there's an independent coordinate system for each one of the... Remember the airplane just had two coordinate frames?
Mm-hmm.
And two coordinate frames and one angle of attack.
Okay.
So each tire has its own independent coordinate frame, especially if you're considering the flexing of the suspension components. So the coordinate frames for each tire are the Earth coordinate frame fixed to the Earth, the orientation of the hub of the tire, which is the part of the tire that doesn't flex. Well, in the future, I'm going to call this hub or wheel. That's the part that doesn't flex, so that means you know where everything is just by accounting for a few numbers, mm-hmm. in particular three numbers, like yaw, pitch, and roll of the hub, except you have four of those. The orientation of the ground plane, so you're going on banked and elevated surfaces, so that's three so far. And then you have the difference between the direction the tire is pointing and the direction the tire is going. Just like angle of attack, in a wing, the angle of attack is the difference between the direction the wing is pointing and the direction the pointing and the direction the wing is going.
Okay.
A tire, you turn that whole thing on its side, and there's an angular difference between the direction the tire is pointing and the direction the tire is going. So that looks just like angle of attack. It generates lateral forces or sideways forces.
Okay.
So you got to deal with that. So we have three coordinate frames plus an angle of attack, but you also have something else. So there's
uh-oh.
More. But wait, there's more.
More. All right.
I was just saying this is the slip angle, which is the difference between, this is my little drawing here. I'm trying to, this dark blob is supposed to represent the patch of rubber that's stuck on the ground.
Okay.
And it kind of twists and turns the carcass of the tire. This circle, this ellipse here with the hash marks in it is supposed to be the part that doesn't move. That's the hub or the wheel.
Okay.
So that we have a frame of reference located with the hub, and we do all of the calculations with respect to, some of the calculations with respect to that frame of reference. But in summary, there's an angular difference between the direction the tire is going, V for velocity, and the direction the tire is pointing, D for pointing. I don't have to figure that out. Alpha is the slip angle. Is this all we need? No, not anywhere near.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, hold your breath. Here we go. What you're looking at on this screen is an industry standard model for tires. It's called the Pajeczka formula. It's been in use since the 80s, I think.
Okay.
And for lateral forces, there are no fewer than 13 parameters that you need to measure in the laboratory to account for the response of a given tire.
Hmm.
So I'm going to summarize the Pajeczka. I'm reminding us here that we have to account for earth and road by banking and elevation. So we have to worry about these coordinate frames. That factors in here. But let me summarize this Pajeczka formula by this graph. So the horizontal axis here is slip angle in degrees. That's that angular difference between the direction the tire is going and the direction the tire is pointing.
Okay.
So positive 10 degrees, that's 10 degrees of slip angle. Tires tend to work in around 3 and 4 degrees, which is a just barely perceptible twist.
Okay.
Difference between the direction you're pointing and the direction you're going. So in other words, the tire is pointing further down the, further across the road than the car is actually going. Well, something very interesting is happening here. If you start from zero slip angle, that means no steering input whatsoever, and you start going up in slip angle, which means going sideways on this graph, let me tell you what the vertical axis here. The vertical axis measures force in thousands of pounds. So that's 5,000 pounds of force right there. That's a lot of force that's really steering the car aggressively. As you start increasing the slip angle, which you do in the cockpit by turning the steering wheel,
okay.
In other words, you're changing the direction the tire is pointing. The tire is still going this way. You change the direction it's pointing. You generate slip angle. This generates a response force from the tire because the contact patch is now starting to rip and skid and twist and wrench on the ground, and it starts to wrench the car sideways. As you increase your steering input, more slip angle, the force goes up and up and up, which is just what you would think it would do. More steering, more force. That's mm-hmm. what you want. Up until a point. And at that point, the tire is now skidding. And more slip gives you less grip. Anybody who's driven on ice has experienced this, or driven way too aggressively on the street, on asphalt, or on a racetrack, where you're up at this peak all the time. Mm-hmm. A race driver is trying to generate the peak force as much as possible, because that gives you the maximum acceleration, that gives you the fastest lap time. So race drivers are always in this sort of almost skidding condition up here. And it's a whole different control regime, because now you're in the cockpit and you're turning the steering wheel and nothing much is changing. Mm-hmm. This is why you will see race drivers near the limit being able to saw that wheel and still be smooth. Because as they're changing the slip angle, the force is not changing very much. As they go into the corner, they're very smooth and careful. When you're top at steady state cornering, you have a lot of playroom that you can play with. If you go over the line, then you'll see race drivers crank the steering wheel the other way to try to catch it. Because now when you're out here, more slip, less grip. In order to regain control and get back up on the peak, you actually have to unwind and counter-steer the wheel. And this is very lurid on dirt tracks where you see them, you know, the cars actually sliding sideways or drifting. And the wheel is turned to the right and the car is going to the left. Hmm. So you're somewhere out here in this perverse regime of the response curve.
Okay.
So that's steering force. The other thing I didn't talk about is it's still not enough.
Jeez.
Because steering is only going side to side. How do you start the car and stop the car? You have an analog to slip angle, which is longitudinal slip. Longitudinal slip measures the difference between the speed with which the hub is turning and the speed with which the tire is turning. So it's very similar to this slip angle, which is the difference between the direction the tire is pointing and the direction the tire is going. Longitudinal slip, you have a difference between the speed with which the hub is turning, which is driven by your gas pedal or brake pedal, and the speed with which the tire is turning, which is lagging behind the hub. So you can see on the drawing here, I've put these little twist marks in to show this is a case where we're accelerating and the hub is turning faster than the tire. So it's bunching up the tire rubber in front here. And this is not highly exaggerated. I've seen some pictures in the lab of putting tires through extreme stresses, and it really bunches up and twists like this. You can also see it on drag races where they have, you know, these 8,000 horsepower cars.
Sure.
And that burn the rubber.
And they burn the rubber, and they twist the P-Wadden out of this rubber like this, and they have paint stripes on the side. And it's really lurid. And I think those tires are only pumped up to a couple of pounds of pressure anyway, maybe five, so that they can get lots of flex. You want lots of twist in those tires because you're just pounding a tremendous amount of force through them.
Sure.
And you want them to flex and not blow up. If they're too stiff, they'll blow up. So this is an accelerating condition where the hub is turning faster than the tire. And on the next page, I have a decelerating condition where the hub is turning slower than the tire and the twist goes the other way. This is a braking condition. Hmm. And it's measured by this parameter sigma, which is kind of parallel to the alpha parameter. And sigma has this feature that it's greater than zero under accelerating and less than zero under braking. And again, these are industry standard definitions. And this caused a lot of problems for us in the gaming business because these industry standard definitions have a problem.
They do.
They're great for the lab. They're great for tire engineers. Mm-hmm. They're great for guys doing, you know, building actual race cars. Mm-hmm. They're not great if you're simulating a race car.
Okay.
And, in fact, I'll tell you something to look for.
All right.
Next time you're driving a good racing game and you pull into the pits, you will notice a marked change in the way the car feels when you slow down. The cars are really hard to control at slow speeds. Let's say you're pulling into the pits or just, you know, driving slow for some reason or another. All the control habits that you built up while racing, let's say you successfully managed to get the car around the track, which is a challenge in a lot of simulators, just getting around without crashing at all.
Okay.
But when you go slow, the cars are now really hard to control. They go sideways, and they feel funny, they feel different. The reason they feel different is that both of these parameters, sigma and alpha, before we get there, this is the Pajeczka formula for the longitudinal response, for the accelerating and the braking. It looks very similar to the Pajeczka formula for cornering, This is the longitudinal slip here, and it also has a linear regime where more slip, more grip. You're putting on more gas pedal or more brake pedal. Gas pedal this way, brake pedal that way. More slip, more grip, up into a point. Up here, you're spinning the tires now, you're smoking the tires. Down here, you've locked the brakes.
Hmm.
Now out here, more slip, less grip. More slip, less grip. The force response begins to go down. This is a perverse region. The curve looks a lot like the lateral form, but in detail, it's quite different. So we actually, in simulating a tire, account for the longitudinal response, the front and back response, and the lateral response, the cornering response. We account for them separately.
Okay.
Similar formulas, but different in detail, and different enough in detail to be really annoying. So this is a lot of mathematics. You can imagine that looking at those formulas that you're not going to be able to do this in a 1984 class computer.
No.
You're not even going to be able, looking at the shape of that curve, to be able to put enough into a table to do table lookup. You'll have many, many thousands of bytes to have an accurate table representation for this kind of thing.
So it's purely about the amount of available
it's
RAM.
Just computing resources, yeah, RAM.
Also processing power, huh? But
well, the trade-off between doing a calculation using a formula or using a table lookup, is a classic time-space trade-off. If you're going to calculate some answer by a formula, mm-hmm. then you have to spend computer time.
Sure.
If you're going to calculate, if it takes too long, then your only alternative is to do a table lookup, which means you pre-compute the answers and store them in a table.
Sure.
And that takes space, so that costs RAM.
Mm-hmm.
And if your computer is just too small and wimpy, you're not going to be able to do either one. It's too slow and it's too small.
Exactly.
The trade-off is you need the computer to be either fast or fat,
mm-hmm.
or hopefully both. I mean, nowadays computers are so amazingly fast, you're going to see some stuff that's going to blow your mind.
Sure.
But in the early days of gaming simulation, they weren't fast and they weren't fat, and so you just couldn't do cars until the 90s. The first good car simulators for PCs came out maybe 96, 97. By 98, the benchmark game was called Grand Prix Legends. That was the one that changed the world. It changed the world for car simulation. It was the first really accurate racing simulator, which means they simulated all the parts in the car, even gears and clutches inside the differential were simulated. And it was as far as the gameplay goes, it was a simulation of the 1967 Formula One racing season.
Hmm.
Now, that was a time when race cars were devilishly difficult to drive. Think about this. Imagine a car that weighed 1,000 pounds, mm-hmm. had 450 horsepower, and tires that weren't as good as 5-year-old tires on a Ford Taurus. That's a 1967 Formula One car.
Nice.
What this really means is that you could almost never use full throttle on the thing. You could be going down the straightaway at 180 miles an hour and bury the throttle and spin out and crash.
Hmm.
So,
yeah.
So to this was very high art. This is driving a car like that is equivalent to Bach improvising a four-part fugue. It was not something that ordinary people could do.
Sure.
You just couldn't even drive a car like this under any circumstances.
Hmm.
Overpowered, not anywhere near enough grip.
Okay.
And it's just that was the ultimate in technology at the time. Now, the dirty little secret of why they simulated the 1967 Formula One season is that those cars didn't have any aerodynamics on them.
Ah.
So the physics simulation for the race cars was just tires and suspension and differential and a couple other things.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to simulate aerodynamics. Aerodynamics changed the entire world of racing, and especially at the top, Formula One and IndyCar.
I bet, yes.
Because it generates downforce. Now the car is both a car and an airplane.
Hmm.
An upside-down airplane where the lift is pushing the car down into the ground
down.
Yeah, to generate more grip on the
certainly.
On the tires. So that was the dirty little secret why they picked 1967.
Cool.
But they actually did. I believe they had the Pajeczka formula in that game, and the computers were, by 1997 or 98, they were fast enough to simulate these things. So there's a problem with this Pajetka formula, and as I was segue back to this thing to notice when you're playing games, this is another one of those examples.
This is great.
The poor student here was supposed to solve a little physics problem, and he got stuck, and he said, well, no, the mass is not going to bounce back from the spring because there's an elephant in the way. We have an elephant in the way, too.
Okay.
And our elephant in the way is called divergence.
Aha.
Divergence is divide by zero.
Ah.
And there are variations on the theme of divide by zero.
Undefined.
Undefined. There's no
mathematically.
Answer. It's infinite, or, you know, it's any number you like.
Yeah.
Yeah, because division means, you know, if x divided by y equals z, then that means x equals y times z. And if z is zero, then y can be anything.
Exactly.
That's what undefined means. Sometimes they call it infinite. Usually it's pretty large, you know. But if looking at both of these angular formulas, the slip angle, the difference between the direction the tire is going and the direction the tire is pointing, if the velocity goes to zero, the angle goes to zero. Oops. And now this Pajetka formula, I mean, as the velocity goes to zero, the angle goes to zero, but at zero, the angle is completely undefined.
Yeah.
So you actually get a divide by zero when you try to just do a computation of the Pajetka formula. And it now says the force on the tire is infinite. Mm-hmm. Remember I said that some of these games, when you start going slow, the car becomes uncontrollable?
Yes.
You're getting divergence in the Pajetka formula.
Aha. So that's important for people to understand.
Yeah.
Let's say that again. So
as you're starting to slow down the car, you are getting a purely artificial increase in the grip forces.
Uh-huh.
The car becomes harder to control, perversely harder to control, incorrectly harder to control, not because it's actually harder to control, but because the simulation, the computation, the computer crap that we have, excuse my language, but the computer computations that we need to do, they're going out of control.
Yeah, because of divergence in the formula.
Divergence in the formula. This the definition of the slip angle now becomes strictly undefined. When the velocity goes to zero, of course we know we want the angle to be zero when the velocity is zero, so now you have to patch the formulas. The point is you can't blindly use the formulas. You can't blindly use the longitudinal slip formula either, because if you rewrite it correctly, you'll find out that there's a velocity in the denominator.
But now, I mean, of course, what causes divergence in the formula to happen in the first place?
Effectively, there is a velocity term in the denominator. And when the velocity goes to zero, this formula blows up. So you have to use a different formula.
Got it.
So what you will see in games is the feeling of the car will change. That's because the physics simulator is changing formulas. And there'll be a nasty region of speeds, usually just about the speed where you're entering the pits, where it'll flicker back and forth between using the real physics simulator, which is starting to diverge, and the simplified formulas, which are not accurate. They're more like arcade. And so the cars just become really unpleasant to drive at some little speed. And I've been able, playing various games, been able to find that spot where I can tell by driving it that the simulator is changing from real physics to faked physics.
Interesting.
Back, yeah.
So, I mean, it's not necessarily a flaw in the formula.
Right.
It's just the fact that the formula is being used in a way that it wasn't designed to be used computationally.
Yes, numerically we can't handle small divisors.
Understood.
You'll overflow integers, you'll overflow floating point numbers, and the whole computation starts to go haywire.
Okay.
So,
all right.
So, that sounds easy. Let's just fix that. But the answer is, surprise, singularities, divergence is everywhere.
Mm.
So there's another problem, and I want to talk about. Let me talk about this first, since you have a camera there. Even in a simple problem where you have two pool balls, or air hockey pucks, if you prefer, this two-dimensional problem, the green one and the red one, and you have a blue one coming into them to strike the two of them at exactly the same time.
Okay.
This seems like a really easy high school physics problem. In fact, it doesn't have an answer.
Hmm.
if you try to do the conservation of energy and momentum.
Well, it does in high school.
Yeah, there's an elephant in the way. Just draw an elephant on your paper, and then you get a zero on your exam. Hey,
well,
I got a zero. What's the problem
creativity.
With that? Yeah, it does.
All right.
It was very cute.
All right.
If you try to simultaneously conserve energy, do an elastic collision, simultaneously conserve momentum and energy, guess what? I'm using Mathematica here because I'm just lazy. There's no solution to parallel two-way collision. It's just you can't solve the two things at the same time. So let's try a different approach, and that is conserve momentum by construction. That means we'll set the response velocity of the green puck to minus A over 2 and the response velocity of the red one to plus, and then the response velocity in the y direction to the two of them. In other words, just conserve and insert the obvious symmetry of the problem. See, what this means over here, when you have no solution, it means you didn't give it, you either gave it not enough information or you gave it too much information.
Interesting.
In this case, we don't have enough information, and we have to add information in the form of putting the evident, the visually evident symmetry into the problem. This is, nobody taught you to solve physics problems in high school this way. You didn't do that. There was just, you know, there's some inputs, and you grind through the problem, and you get the answer. There's only one answer. Well, here there isn't. There are either no answers, or there are an infinite number of answers. And this is an unbelievably simple problem. Divergence is everywhere. Let's go back to flight simulator versus car simulator. In the flight simulator, the thing is in the air. Everything's nice and smooth and everything. In the car simulator, you have four wheels on the ground. Well, guess what? Four is too many. Anybody who's been to a restaurant and had a table that's rocking with four legs on the ground knows that four is too many. Three is the right number. Now, you can get an accurate solution if you have just three tires on the ground. But if you have four tires on the ground, you have to add information, symmetry information. Can't solve it. The physics, the ordinary physics that you would just grind through by doing equations, doesn't work. Doesn't give you an answer.
Yeah.
It's even worse than this. The car is in contact with the ground. Contact is a very difficult problem. There are ways to make it simple, and all the real games make it simple in various ways of cheating. But you can't, in high school and college physics, it's not considered a hard problem at all. You just put in a Lagrange multiplier and put in a holonomic constraint, and even a non-holonomic constraint, and you know, you just solve for the Lagrange multiplier, and it's no problem. That's the standard college thing. And when you do it on a computer, computer doesn't know from Lagrange multipliers. Computer says numbers, 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 and the problem is you're doing little finite time steps. You know, you're time stepping along at a 30th of a second or a 60th of a second. That's your frame rate. The car can actually penetrate the ground. The tire can go through the ground, and that's non-physical. You can't have that, so you got to back it up, or you got to predict that ahead of time, or you have to penalize that activity. Those are the three major approaches. Anyways, I've got PhD theses. People still working on this kind of problem. Very complicated. It's just a variation of this pool balls problem. You got multiple things touching at the same time. Anything more than two things touching at the same time, you now have additional difficulties. Mathematical difficulties, numerical difficulties. People still doing research on this.
Absolutely. I mean, it's important to point out that in college, not necessarily in high school as well, maybe in advanced class, but the point is in college and beyond, when you're doing physics problems, you're doing them on paper. They're purely abstract for the most part. In this case, the computer actually has to try to render it in a realistic mode.
That's right.
And so it has a whole different scale of problems. I mean, I just wanted to stress that that's what you're talking about when you say, on the one sense, it's purely abstract. On the other sense, a computer is trying to create an environment that looks and feels real.
Yeah, a computer is just a fancy calculator, and you have a 60th of a second to compute from the current state to the next state. That's 17 milliseconds. It's not a lot of time.
Yeah.
And you have to do all of these computations with the tires and the suspension and the body roll and penetrating the ground. Oops, I shouldn't have done that. And all of this stuff, it's a lot of physics to do in 17 milliseconds.
Absolutely.
And then you have these researching problems. Really, there are a lot of choices for handling these kind of divergences, and it's surprising to people who've never done any computational physics that problems like this even exist. This is surprising to people. I show people this three pool balls thing, and they say, no, you're kidding. There's something wrong here. Mm-hmm. There has to be a solution. Isaac Newton would have been losing sleep on this. Well, Isaac Newton didn't even look at this.
So when you're shooting, when I'm playing pool,
yeah,
you're telling me that, you know, when I think that I know what I'm doing based on angles,
yeah,
there's a chance that it's going to actually, there's going to be a divergence.
There is a divergence. If you manage to hit two of these balls at exactly the same time, the answer would be undetermined.
Interesting. I'm going to remember that next time I'm out.
The reality is, in the real world, you don't ever hit them at exactly the same time. One hits just a tiny bit before the other, mm-hmm. or there's a little squish in the balls. There's actually just enough squish in the balls. You'll see really good pool tricksters mm-hmm. are able to hit two balls and get them to go out symmetrically.
Absolutely.
If you don't hit them at the same time, by the way, which is what we have to do in the computational world, you have to pick one first, mm-hmm. you get an asymmetrical answer. So here's the symmetrical input. Mm-hmm. We pick the green one first and do the ordinary computation. This is just the regular high school physics. And then you do the red one with the velocity that's left over in the blue ball, and you end up with this answer. You notice the green one gets more momentum than the red one. So just by numerically picking the green one first, you get a different answer than if you had picked the red one first.
Interesting.
So, an alternative is, I don't know, you just have to pick something. You look back at the analytic solution, you just have to pick, how much of the input energy am I going to dump into the two remaining balls? Mm. And if you do a real accurate pool ball simulation with spin and English and friction and stuff like that, then you can begin to answer these questions more accurately. Mm-hmm. But if you just do a simple-minded one like this, you're going to have to make some decisions, arbitrary decisions in the game code.
Okay.
So this is what people do.
So a pool simulator isn't necessarily that easy to pull off, huh?
Not at all. Not at all. You do an accurate pool simulator, you really have to simulate the flex of the balls. They're not really rigid. They're very stiff, but somewhat elastic. Stiffness is its whole set of problems, too, which nobody knows how to solve in general. There are no general solutions to stiffness. I'll explain that maybe if we get to it. Mm-hmm. Where was I going here?
Save the day.
Yeah, let's save the day here.
All right.
Here's the source of the divergence in the longitudinal slip. If you rewrite longitudinal slip, you find that there's a velocity in the denominator. When the velocity goes to zero, the slip becomes infinite. This is bad.
Okay.
So you really need to replace slip with some kind of vector equation. This display over here shows that the same vector equation works in all eight cases of slip versus hub motion versus car motion. And I wrote a couple of little papers on this, but the point is to show that no matter how you arrange the direction of the hub motion and the tire motion and the slip, the same vector equation gives you a consistent answer. So you can use one vector equation and we can get out of this.
Excellent.
And you can boil the whole thing down into one response curve for one slip variable. So you get one vector function result giving you one vector slip variable. And then we can see something interesting. The response curve has this circular shape region.
It's a black hole.
It's a black hole. It's just like a black hole. All of this stuff feels like a black hole when you work on it for years. But down in here is the linear region. So what we're accounting for here is there's the lateral slip this way. Now it's normalized between 1 and minus 1, with 1 being the slip value where you're starting to slide.
Okay.
It's not degrees anymore. It's just whatever your tire will give you. And then in this direction, this is the longitudinal slip, how much gas or how much brake you're giving it. And again, the 1 and minus 1 is locking up the minus 1 is locking up the brakes. Plus 1 is giving it so much gas that you're spinning the tires. And you'll notice this rim up here, which is where the racer wants to live, generating maximum force all the time.
Okay.
It's circular. What does that mean? That means if you're accelerating at maximum 1G, say 1G, and you turn the steering wheel, you have to let off on the gas or you will lose control. Losing control means going out here into this perverse region where you're now trying to recover the car. You're adding more slip and getting less grip. You're getting less grip out here. So you'll see racers doing this. As they turn, they have to let off the gas or let off the brake. and vice versa. As you're unwinding the steering wheel, you can start adding gas and adding brake. When training drivers to drive on a racetrack, I will tell them, imagine a rope. I learned this from my teachers. Imagine a rope wrapped around the steering column that goes to the brake pedal. And as you turn the steering wheel, you must lift the brake pedal because that rope is pulling it up. Mm. You have to teach this coordinated motion to drivers, because on the street, you're always down here inside the black hole region where everything is linear. And you don't have to change the brake pressure when you turn the steering wheel, because all you're doing is just kind of riding around inside this safe region here where more control input gives you more output, more reaction from the tires. But up here, you have to be very, very careful and coordinate the pedal inputs, the gas and the brake, with the steering.
That assumes that I'm traveling at rates, at a velocity where I could run into a problem with slippage and crashing.
Yes, and that's what you're doing on a racetrack all the time.
Yeah,
trying to go as fast as possible. You're trying to create as much, you're trying to get as much speed as the tires will allow you to do. Mm-hmm. And what tires do is they generate changes in speed, either accelerating or braking or cornering.
Okay.
Which is a change in speed. When you're cornering, you're changing the direction of that you're going, but it's actually a change in the velocity vector. And accelerating braking is obviously a change in speed. So racers are always trying to use the tires to give them the quickest change in their speeds. If they have to corner, of course, you don't want to do any of that if you don't have to, right? You just want to go in a dead straight line as much as you possibly can, because that's as fast as you can possibly go. But real road courses twist and turn, so you have to turn. So now you're going to try to get around the corner as fast as you possibly can, which means you want the tire to give you as much force as it can possibly give you, which means you're riding around on the rim of this bucket all the time. And so now the activities that you have to do in the control activities that you have to do in the cockpit are coordinating the pedals and the steering wheel. And this one picture shows you that. Kind of, this is why I call it better driving through physics.
That's good.
Now, this is another kind of thing. The whole lesson of this, of what I'm trying to get across in this talk, is that the exercise of doing computational physics for games is an exercise in doing more with less. You want to try to get as much physics as you can get for the minimum amount of computational resources. Do as little computation as you can get away with, uses the least amount of memory that you need to get the most amount of physics out of it. More bang for the buck is another way of putting it.
Okay. But, I mean, does that still matter in the day where
we're
going to have 80 cores and 10,000 gigs of RAM or whatever?
Absolutely.
It still matters.
Absolutely, because game designers, you give game designers a fatter, faster computer and they'll just throw more things in it.
Okay.
So now that we've mastered the physics of one complicated thing,
yeah,
they'll put a whole track full of 40 cars out there.
Okay.
Or 100 cars or 1,000 cars. They'll have exploding boxes and bullets and airplanes and helicopters and it's just more stuff.
Now let me ask you this. I mean, since you were involved with the creation of a racing game, I would assume that the surface upon which the tires are acting on, is pretty much across the board uniform.
Yeah.
So in other words, you're not going to create a really realistic track to add complexity to your equations. Or, because your equations are so perfect, that wouldn't matter. Right? So not my question. So you're assuming like in classic high school physics, there's no gravity when you're going down something, right? Or there's no friction.
There's no friction, right.
So, so the math is a hell of a lot easier.
Yes.
So in a game, obviously there's friction, but then there's also going to be uneven surfaces, slick surfaces, headwinds, sidewinds.
Yes.
So all that stuff you have accounted for.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And in fact, we can even do bumpy roads. Rocky roads, roads with cracks and holes and crevasses in them,
and it's no problem.
It's a lot of problem.
Well, for you,
for us, but for the game, when once we get the game built and designed, then we have to do all that stuff.
That's really interesting. I mean, it would be kind of cool because I know with Flight Simulator, one of the cool things is I can control the weather environment.
Yes,
because I'm trying to learn how to fly.
Yeah,
so I mean, not me literally, but
no,
me as in somebody who's playing the game.
Right.
So. you say it's nighttime, it's raining, there's headwinds, and, you know, whatever.
Right.
And maybe some hail and some shear over to my right and whatever.
Right.
And then it becomes a lot more interesting and complicated.
Right.
For a racing game, I could say, all right, I got headwinds, or I got side winds, and I have an aerodynamic car.
Yes.
I have side winds. I'm on a really interesting surface that has oil spills in various random locations.
Yes, yes. Or bumps.
Bumps.
Bumpy tracks are really exciting.
And the guy behind me has been drinking. Or in front of me. He's throwing the whiskey bottles.
No, that must be a NASCAR game. Right?
Yeah.
Moonshine bottles.
There
right?
you go. So the math can account for all of this.
Yes. In fact, we brought up NASCAR. In a lot of NASCAR type events where there's sustained high speeds, the aerodynamics of multiple cars together become a dominant factor. The guy in front of you is generating a slipstream that you're trying to hide in, and he may try to cause you to slow down by manipulating that slipstream and pulling it off your car. Dale Earnhardt, bless his soul, was the consummate master at this. I used to see him do tricks where he would feign to the left, causing the guy to overcorrect, and then he'd go up to the right, and then he'd go back again a couple more, three or four times, and he'd end up in front of the guy. It just was like magic. And it was like playing chess at 200 miles an hour, playing chess with, you know, he would figure out what your move was going to be in response to his move and maybe do that two or three plies. And he was just better at it than the average bear. Also, when a car passes you, of course, this causes anybody who's been passed by a truck at high speed knows what that feels like. That can scare the pants off you.
Yeah.
And on a track where you're at the limit of adhesion all the time, this can easily cause you to lose control.
Absolutely.
You hit a dust bunny and you're going to lose control on these things. So, that's teeth grinding stuff. And that's on a perfect track, a bumpy track with debris.
Insane.
The variety and richness that we can put in these games. Oh, I have to say about the gaming marketplace, too.
Mm-hmm.
There is a difference between the simulation junkies and the regular game players. The simulation junkies want a more accurate game.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care if it's harder to drive. They want it more accurate. They want all of these little effects in there. They want to feel the effect of a tiny spot of oil on the track on each one of the tires independently and that kind of thing. The regular game player can't deal with this kind of thing because it would just crash.
Sure.
But so the simulation junkie market is quite small. Grand Prix Legends got a lot of... it's a cult.
Okay.
These were people who were willing. The ordinary game player was not able to operate that game. It was so accurate that, of course, you would just get in those cars and you would crash in the first corner.
Okay.
And you'd work on it for 3 hours and you were still crashing in the first corner.
Nice.
Because they were so devilishly difficult to drive. But for the simulation junkie, that's exactly what he was looking for, because that's what the real cars were like.
Okay.
So, and that dichotomy exists today. People who... the market for Project Gotham is different from the market for Forza. There's a boundary between the two where, you know, a lot of games will allow you to crank up the simulation fidelity.
Mm-hmm.
Fidelity is another word for accuracy.
Mm.
More fidelity, harder to drive.
Sure.
Thing about simulation versus real cars, in a real car you have gravitational inertial feeling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When the car starts to slide, you feel it, actually. And what it feels like is the car's getting... loose. It's getting squirrely. You can actually feel it.
Sure.
And you can make these corrections and, you know, you can... whereas in a simulator, the only cue you have is what's on the screen.
Mm.
So what we'll do in the gaming business is we'll exaggerate these effects. When the car gets squirrely, it'll start to maybe wiggle a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
In a real car, you feel it before you see it. In a simulation, we'll exaggerate the visual effects so the poor schmo driving it will have a chance to see it and correct it.
Now, you could also send out events to hardware.
Yes.
If someone has a steering wheel that
feels
vibration.
You. Absolutely. The force feedback stuff is
really
great.
Ah.
It's really great. I love force feedback equipment. And for the super high dollar market, there are actually seats that have hydraulics in them.
Nice.
And, you know, they'll lean the chair this way and that way and bump it and yank it around.
Wow.
But that's in the $100,000 plus range.
You know, got it. That's in Bill's basement.
That's maybe in Bill's basement. Oh, I don't actually know if Bill is a racing fanatic. Yeah, I don't. Probably not. So this was a little formula that I stole from thermodynamics. One of the advantages of being a physicist is that I have access to secret knowledge, ancient physics wisdom.
Okay.
This is something called Fermi-Dirac statistics, or maybe it's Bose-Einstein. The difference between Fermi-Dirac and Bose-Einstein is the difference between plus and minus, and I forget off the top of my head which is which. But I remember when I was doing this tire physics, I remembered this shape of this curve from thermodynamics, quantum thermodynamics. Mm. And, you know, I have seen this somewhere before. Somewhere in my ancient physics wisdom, I saw this. Ah, yes, I remember. Okay. And I was able to pull out this little formula, which has 3 parameters instead of 23.
Nice.
And do a pretty good job of matching the Pajeczka formula with this thing. So now we can go to smaller platforms. And do interesting driving simulations. We don't have to have big, fat, fast computers. We don't have to have gaming rigs. Maybe we can do simulation on ordinary computers. Maybe we can do it on, who knows, small platforms of the future.
Interesting.
Interesting, yes. Doing more with less. Okay, now I want to show you one more thing. Radically simplify. These are screenshots from a couple of miraculous programs. What has happened is that Moore's Law, as we've been talking about all through this, it has finally caught up with physics.
Wow.
Now we can do better simulations, not through more complicated mathematics, and not through more physicists' leisure domain and ancient physics wisdom and all of these kind of Lagrange multipliers and crazy things.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if we can just use very simple physics like a particle system. Particle system means there's nothing in the physics except particles and sticks. Sticks and stones is what I call it. This guy called it rigs of rods.
Mm-hmm.
Stones, which have mass, and sticks in between them, which are little flexible things. We know how to model this with very simple physics. Remember harmonic oscillator by any chance?
Yes, I do.
So that's all you need. Just one physics model, a harmonic damped harmonic oscillator,
okay,
connecting pairs of stones, or of stones, that's what I'll call it.
Mm-hmm.
And by gum, you can simulate really amazing. If we have 5 minutes, I want to show you.
Sure, of course. This is a hard drive camera.
Oh, good. I'm kind of losing track of time here, but I have.
That's because you're a physicist. It's just a variable.
It's just another variable. I have to show you this amazing rigs of rods movie. I got this off of YouTube, and it changed the way that I look. It changed the way that I look at simulation physics. I'm going to show you another one, too. I actually have this program running, but rather than take the risk of my ham-handedness with it, I'm going to just show a movie. And here it is. This is mind-boggling. It's about 5 minutes long. Let me move it over here. And full screen it. Now, I'm going to walk you through. I told you there's nothing in here but sticks and stones. There's nothing in here but particles and harmonic oscillators. And yet, this is one of the best driving simulations I have ever seen. I'm going to point out some features. You can start seeing the body flex.
Nice.
Look at the tires turning and flexing. Look at the bouncing.
Mm-hmm.
You see the chassis flexing, you'll really see it on this one. Watch the bed of this truck flex and twist. When we first started doing car simulators in the 90s, we just got tires. Oh, watch the cargo container twist.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. See that?
Yeah.
Is that magnificent?
It's realistic.
It was years before anybody could do something that good. Now he's starting to give away the punchline here, because you can see that this bed of this truck is made up of just sticks and stones.
Hmm.
This is very good. Used to be we would have to do a whole different physics engine for articulated bodies. One physics engine for cars, another one for articulated bodies, another one for multi-wheel trucks. This, you can begin to see how dirty the surface is. It's cracked. Sand is coming up onto the side of the road. He's up on two wheels there. Here's a road that's got a lot of cracks in it, which is what you were asking about before, bad road surfaces. So this is a road where he's just driving this truck over the... Now, here we have destruction, comprehensive destruction. So the way you deal with this, using sticks and stones, is if you overwhelm one of these sticks, then you just permanently deform it or you break it. Boom! Permanent deformation. You overwhelm it with either too much force or with too quick a change, which turns out to be the same, the two sides of the same coin. Here, this is articulated bodies again. Again, I'll hold it in, I'm using traditional methods. Watch this. Did you see the bed of the truck goes down and flexes a little bit as he lifts up this thing? Absolutely magnificent. Using traditional methods to simulate a system like that would be just a whole separate physics. And here he's giving away the joke. This is the punchline. There is nothing in this simulator but particles and harmonic oscillators. Hmm. Fantastic. Unfortunately, I've forgotten the fellow's name who did this.
Rigs of Rods. That's
Rigs of Rods.
That's his URL.
That's his URL. Go look this stuff up. This is great stuff. The physics is simple. Mm. We're back now to 10 lines of physics. Remember the flight simulator?
Yeah.
Where it was 10 lines of physics to do the flight simulation? We're back to that. But how can we do these complicated objects with only 10 lines of physics? Horsepower. The computer is now fast enough to be able to simulate hundreds or thousands of these independent systems simultaneously every step.
Excellent.
Moore's law has caught up. We can now dispense with this really hard mathematics of the traditional methods and go into using very simple systems iterated hundreds or thousands of times, and the computer can handle it. Okay. Computer's fast enough to do this in 60 frames a second. If you had asked me, you know, this is sometimes why it takes somebody coming at a problem from it. If you had asked me to bet money that this were even possible, I would have said no. Hmm. But that's because I have this long experience where you just didn't even think about doing thousands of particles iterated in a system like this. Hmm. Here's a guy who took a fresh approach. He said, you know what, let me see what I can do. And sure enough, this is a magnificent system.
Excellent. So we're going to start seeing systems like this then in games, or
I think
there.
We are. I think we are going to see them. I am certainly going to use his methods. Obviously, we'll not look at any of his source code or anything like that. But the methods are obvious, and I would certainly give the guy credit for coming up with this invention. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic invention. And I would love to use those methods in commercial games. I haven't yet, but who knows? We would love to do that.
Excellent.
Now let me show you another one. This is another case where horsepower... Let's see. Actually, this is the Redux. You go back to this, and I'll actually try to execute this program in real time. Always the hard part is just finding it. I might not have installed it on this machine. Let me take one last look. It's called Plasma Pong. I don't see it there. All right, what I'll do is I'll play a movie. This operates at... The movie is chunky, but the game actually operates at very, very good at high... this is 30 frames a second, you can see there, which is plenty good enough for a good feel. Mm. This is the original game of Pong, except the Pong ball and the paddles are moving in a fluid that is being simulated in real time.
Okay.
Being simulated and colored in real time. Fluid physics is traditionally extremely difficult. The equations are nonlinear, very complicated, and nonlinear means bad.
Okay.
By the way, the real game plays nice and smooth. This was a little chunky. It's just an artifact of making.
It's a Pong from the 60s.
It's Pong maybe even the 60s, but now updated to do real time high horsepower physics simulation of real fluids in real time.
Interesting.
Absolutely fabulous. A must download. You must go download this game if you like.
Okay.
If you like this kind of stuff. it just knocked my socks off. The Rigs of Rods knocked my socks off.
Okay.
The Plasma Pong knocked my socks off.
All right.
And these are my two examples. I've looked into the math and physics behind Plasma Pong.
Okay.
And roughly, the guy has a couple of really great ideas.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems with doing integration is that it's unstable. Mm-hmm. The numerical errors that you get accumulate over time, and then they push the simulation out of control. He figured out a way of doing this by a backwards-looking method. Instead of computing from your current state forward, pushing the errors forward and making them bigger, he said, let me figure out what my next state will be by looking at my last state and averaging together the errors. Now if you have a little plus here and a little minus there, they cancel each other out, and it stabilizes the thing. It stabilizes simulation. Beautiful, beautiful. Wow. And this kind of technique can be used in other places as well.
Excellent.
Not just in... So these are some good lessons that were learned.
And this is who, Joss?
This is Jostam.
Jostam.
This is his little technique. This is computing forward, where things tend to blow up.
Mm-hmm.
This is computing from the past into the future, where things smooth out and average out. Beautiful.
Excellent.
Got a couple of other very pretty mathematical tricks to make it look realistic. And probably should wrap up now, because mm-hmm. I'll get into the next hour of ranting and raving. But suffice it to say that Plasma Pong and Rigs of Rods are examples of where I think physics and gaming is going in the future.
Okay.
We now have, you brought this up before, we now have with multi-core a tremendous amount of computing horsepower available.
Mm-hmm.
With things like the CUDA compiler from NVIDIA, we have the power of the graphics processor itself can be brought to bear on ordinary problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I can now write ordinary C programs and use, or abuse, if you like, the graphics hardware, which
sure.
is just a number cruncher, to solve physics problems. This is great.
Mm-hmm.
There's physics hardware coming out. There's a company called Aegea that has put out a physics simulation card that you can snap into your PCI slot.
Nice.
So I can load it for $5,000, which is what a lot of gamers won't admit to spending on their gaming rigs.
Mm-hmm.
I can load a computer with so much computing horsepower that I can do things that I can do very advanced physics with simple equations, simple systems
mm-hmm.
that are stabilized. They don't have these problems with a collision detection, collision response that are people are still writing PhD theses on.
Mm-hmm.
Simpler mathematics, more horsepower, this is where I think things are going. And it's just another case of doing more with less.
Certainly. Now, I would ask this. Now, there is another pink elephant in the room.
Yeah.
And that is actually writing this stuff.
Yes.
Right? I mean, it's one thing to have the beautiful, the simplistic physics and the harmonic oscillation
yeah.
and such and that. But developers, like, the real-world people that write games
yes.
are in the world of dealing with the complexities of writing concurrent code.
Yes.
It's not easy.
No.
And they need to be able to be... These are highly concurrent systems that we just watched on the movie.
Highly concurrent, yes.
And so there's also that problem of making it easier for these guys to take the physics and actually implement the physics.
Yes.
In a real-world game scenario.
Yes.
Hitting modern hardware.
Yes.
So there's more work to be done in that level of problems, yes?
There is definitely more work to be done there. And another thing that I was fortunate enough to work on back in the 80s was called the Time Warp Operating System.
I remember that from our first interview.
This
is that coming back?
This is coming back. It is being used today.
Really?
In physics simulators. Just found a thesis by Brian Mirtick from Berkeley about 10 years ago. He implemented the time warp mechanism, exactly the same one that Jefferson and I put together,
uh-huh.
but in order to do concurrent physics simulation. If you have lots of these objects computing in parallel,
yeah.
just let them compute optimistically and then synchronize them only when you can prove there's a mistake.
Hmm.
He absolutely does that.
Excellent.
So, yes, there's plenty more work to do, but we also had some good ideas in the past that we
sure.
that we can bring to bear now. And so this is a really great time to be involved in this gig.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So just in conclusion, why don't you wrap all
yes.
of this up in a nice, neat package to end on.
Okay. because computing horsepower is becoming really capable right now, more and more games have physics features in them. And then there are sort of two pathways for practitioners in the art of gaming physics to go. One pathway is the traditional pathway where we do more complicated physics using more sophisticated mathematics. And that is certainly a living, breathing, you know, way to go. But then there's this other more exciting, to my view, more exciting one, where you just overwhelm the problem with computing horsepower. And Rigs of Rods and Plasma Pong show the results that can be done with this. And then finally, there's the big horizon of small platforms or ubiquitous platforms like browsers. People are beginning to do 3D in browsers. There are some with Silverlight and Flash. There are some people using these things to do 3D, even though they're not 3D. They're not overtly 3D systems. You can still do some pretty interesting 3D with them. Add some physics, and maybe we can write games for these things. Maybe we can write gaming platforms for these things. I don't want to give anything away, but you know, we're certainly thinking along these lines: small platforms, ubiquitous platforms. People are playing with smartphones. They have games on them. Why not put a little physics in those games? We can do some interesting things with this.
Absolutely.
So this is the hookup with Tesla Project and with programming languages. One of the things I would like to do is make game just exactly as you said, make it easier for developers to write games. So now this is the tie-in with the programming language and platforms. Work that we're doing here, and that's the tie-in with Link and Tesla.
Sure.
Link and Tesla is all about making programs in general easier to write, and since games are a compelling application area and a growing application area, especially on the ubiquitous and small platforms, the tie-in now is I want to make games easier to write for games, very particularly games with physics in them. So that's why I had this great opportunity to drag out all this old physics work that I've been doing for many years.
Very cool. Well, I look forward to seeing something arise out of this.
There definitely will be.
Okay, excellent.
Who knows when?
Who knows when? But the point of this interview isn't about to talk about something that we're actually working on. It's more talking about, you know, what you're working on.
Yes,
are interesting problems in physics as they apply to computation.
Exactly. I'm an incubation. I'm not in Microsoft research, but I'm a researcher in the product groups, so to speak. I work on incubation and prototypes. So we don't have any product plans like this, but these are the kind of directions where I'm thinking about going in the near term. You know, the next 3 to 5 years.
Cool.
And so I thought. Be fun to share that with you.
Absolutely. Well, this is Channel 9, right?
We're
bringing the camera into the cockpit.
Awesome.
To let people know what's going on.
I love this. I love this.
Very cool.
I think Channel 9 is the greatest thing ever.
Right on, man. Well, I know Niners are going to be psyched to see another Brian Beckman interview, so thank
you
for your time.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care.